Welcome to this deep dive into a foundational case in patent law, United States v. Duplier Condenser Corp. This one's from 1933. It tackles a really fundamental question. When a government employee invents something using government resources, well, who gets the patent?
Exactly. And this decision laid down some crucial principles for intellectual property rights in the employment context. And it remains, you know, surprisingly relevant today for anyone in innovative fields or maybe working on government-funded projects.
Yeah, absolutely. We've pulled together a range of materials, case briefs, analysis, the works, and our mission today is to unpack this landmark ruling for you.
Right. And at the heart of this legal matter are two individuals, Dunmore and Lowell. They were researchers at the Bureau of Standards. Think of it as the U.S. government's official science and testing organization back then.
Okay.
And they developed some interesting new technologies related to radio. But then they went and obtained patents for these inventions themselves.
Ah, okay. So that's where the conflict starts.
That's where the crux of the issue arises, yeah. The U.S. government asserted that they should own those patents. So you can immediately see the conflict between the individual inventors and their government employer.
Okay, let's get into the core of this dispute, though. The big question here is whether the government automatically gains ownership of patents created by its employees just because they're, you know, employed by the government, using government facilities and resources, maybe working during official hours.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important to note here, though, that Dunmore and Lowell's employment didn't include any specific agreement, no contract requiring them to assign their patent rights to the government. That absence is key, isn't it?
Absolutely. That absence of a contract is a really key element here.
Right.
And to really understand the Supreme Court's reasoning, we need a bit more detail about Dunmore and Lowell's situation. They were indeed working within the radio section of the Bureau of Standards, and their work involved research and testing in that area. However, what's fascinating here is that the specific inventions they patented weren't assigned tasks. They weren't, like, directed to invent these particular radio technologies.
Ah, so it wasn't their specific job description to invent this thing.
Exactly. Instead, these innovations seem to have stemmed from their own initiative, their own curiosity, while they were conducting their broader research within the government labs.
So this sets the stage for the central legal question. In the absence of a specific law or a contractual obligation, does the government have an inherent right to inventions made by its employees just because public money and facilities were involved?
Yeah, it's about figuring out the default position when there's no explicit agreement in place.
And that brings us to the Supreme Court's majority opinion, which was delivered by Justice Roberts. What did they find?
Well, the court's central finding was quite clear and honestly has had a lasting impact. Patent rights belong to the individual who invented the technology unless there is a specific agreement, a contract, that explicitly states otherwise. They really emphasize this principle of individual ownership.
Right, and this is where the important hired-to-invent test comes in. Can you explain that?
Sure. The court articulated that ownership only transfers from the inventor to the employer if the employee was specifically hired or directed to invent the particular technology in question.
Okay.
So it wasn't sufficient that Dunmore and Lowell were generally employed as researchers in the field of radio. Their broader research responsibilities didn't automatically equate to being specifically hired to invent the particular devices they patented.
And it's a really crucial nuance.
It is. The court articulated this point very directly, and it's a phrase that's often cited. Patent rights belong to the inventor unless explicitly assigned. That statement really encapsulates the core of the majority's decision.
Okay.
The court also emphasized the underlying purpose of patent law itself, you know, to encourage innovation by rewarding inventors for disclosing their inventions, which ultimately benefits the public.
But as often happens with big Supreme Court decisions, there wasn't unanimous agreement, was there? We had some dissenting voices.
Precisely. Justices Stone and Hughes offered a dissenting opinion.
And what was their perspective?
Well, they raised a compelling counterargument. Their primary concern centered on the fact that, you know, public funds and public resources were used in developing these inventions.
Right, taxpayer money.
Exactly. Therefore, they argued that the public should be the primary beneficiary and have unrestricted access to these technologies without the barrier of privately held patents.
So their viewpoint was essentially that it's just not equitable for individuals to exclusively profit from inventions that were developed using taxpayer money and government facilities.
That's the gist of it, yes. They believed it was unfair to allow government employees to essentially privatize innovations that arose directly from publicly funded research. Justice Hughes even went so far as to suggest a rather strong remedy.
Which was?
That the patents in question should be completely canceled.
Wow, okay. That represents a pretty significant difference of opinion on the court. So, while the majority sided with the inventors on ownership, the dissent had this strong argument about public benefit. But the story doesn't quite end there, does it? The court did acknowledge the government's contribution somehow.
Yes, that's right. That's where the concept of shop rights comes into play. While the government didn't gain outright ownership of the patents, the court recognized the government's contribution, you know, providing the lab space, equipment, and other resources that helped make the inventions possible.
Okay, so how did they address that?
To address this, they granted the government what are known as shop rights. Essentially, it's a non-exclusive, royalty-free license, meaning the government had the right to use the inventions for governmental purposes without having to pay any royalties to Dunmore and Lowell.
Got it. So just to be clear for our listeners, this didn't give the government the power to stop others like private companies from using the inventions, right?
Yeah. Correct. No exclusivity. The ownership of the patents remained with Dunmore and Lowell or whoever they licensed them to, but the government secured the right to utilize the technology as needed for public benefit.
Okay, so it's like Dunmore and Lowell own the blueprint, but the government gets a permanent free pass to make and use copies for its own operations.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
We also had Justice Cardozo offering a concurring opinion. Where did his perspective fit into this? He didn't quite agree with the majority or the dissent.
Well, Cardozo's concurring opinion adds an interesting layer. He actually agreed with the dissenting justices on the importance of ensuring the public benefits from research funded by the government. That part resonated with him.
Okay.
However, he also recognized the significant role of the inventors' own ingenuity, their independent thinking and initiative as a crucial factor that, you know, deserved consideration and reward.
So he was trying to bridge the gap.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
Acknowledging both the public investment and the individual creative contribution, it was a more nuanced position.
Okay, so we've covered the facts, the central legal question, the majority and dissenting opinions, and this concept of shop rights. Now, let's bring this forward. Why is this nearly century-old case still relevant for our listeners, especially those studying law today?
Well, Dubilier Condenser has had a profound and lasting impact on IP law and practice. One of the most direct consequences is the now, well, almost universal inclusion of explicit intellectual property assignment clauses in employment contracts.
Ah, okay. So that clause you sign when you start a tech job.
Exactly. Especially in industries focused on innovation and technology, companies learned a clear lesson from Dubilier. If they want to ensure they own the inventions their employees create, they need to clearly and unequivocally state that in a written agreement.
That makes perfect sense. So if you're working in a research lab or a tech company today, it's almost guaranteed your employment agreement will have some very specific language about who owns any patents you might develop during your employment. No ambiguity left.
Absolutely. And the hired to invent doctrine, it remains a crucial framework for interpreting these clauses even today. Courts will often look at whether an employee was specifically tasked with solving a particular problem or inventing a specific technology.
Right.
You can contrast this with someone in a more general research role, maybe exploring fundamental scientific principles. The application of the hired to invent test can lead to different outcomes in terms of patent ownership.
Like the example you mentioned earlier, a university researcher versus an engineer hired to design something specific.
Precisely. The legal analysis of who owns resulting patents would likely differ based on this doctrine established way back in Dubilier.
And it also highlights this ongoing tension in intellectual property law, doesn't it? This balance between incentivizing individual innovation through patent rights and the public interest in ensuring broad access, especially when public funds are involved.
It truly is a fundamental tension. You see it with research coming out of government agencies or universities receiving government grants. It's a constant balancing act with significant policy implications.
Yeah.
And for law students, Dubilier Condenser serves as an invaluable case study. It's a prime example of statutory interpretation, how contract law principles intersect with IP rights and, you know, the Supreme Court's role in balancing competing policy considerations.
And it really hammers home the importance of clear contracts.
Absolutely. It underscores the critical importance of clear and express contractual language in avoiding future disputes and providing clarity on IP ownership right from the start.
Okay, so to summarize the key takeaway from this deep dive into United States v. Dublier Condenser Corp., basically, unless there's a clear contract saying otherwise, or unless you were specifically hired to invent that specific thing, the default rule is that employees keep the rights to their inventions, even if they used employer resources.
Mm-hmm. That's the core of it. This case established the crucial need for explicit IP agreements and gave us the concept of shop rights as a way to kind of acknowledge the employer's contribution without giving them full ownership.
Right. It's a foundational case that continues to shape how we understand and approach intellectual property rights in employment and research, particularly when government resources are involved.
Precisely. Still very relevant.
And on that note, here's a final thought for you to consider. Given the incredible pace of technological innovation we're seeing today, and the increasing role of government funding in, well, all sorts of research fields, how effectively do you believe the balance struck in Dublier nearly a century ago still serves both goals, fostering innovation and promoting the public good in our 21st century world?
That's the big question, isn't it?
Yeah. This case offers a really important lens through which to critically examine those ongoing debates surrounding intellectual property rights in our rapidly evolving technological landscape. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.